Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in with a question. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We'll get you on pretty fast. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It's so nice to be here on such a beautiful day.
You always come up with some interesting little news bits, and you've got another one for us today.
It just came in my DVM magazine that comes to my house. It's kind of, I call it like the veterinarian's bathroom reading. You know, please don't tell them that. It's actually kind of a fun little journal that I get, but they had an article in their trends section, which I hope does not become a big trend across the country. But you've heard of like Netflix and all those things mm-hmm. where you can, you know, rent videos. Well, how about rent a pet? Yeah. Mm. You buy memberships, $300 a month, and you get a pet for 4 days, a dog. And this is like, you know, in cities and so on. Mm. So if you, you know, have a hot date and you want to, you know, have a chick magnet, you can, you know, get that cute little dog to borrow for a little while. Yeah, I think it's, you know, when you look at it, yes, these are pets that are coming usually from shelters and rescue groups that are, you know, trained and so on so that they're well-behaved and housebroken and that kind of thing. But, you know, pets form such strong bonds with us and, you know, to have them move from home to home all the time, it just kind of wrangles me, you know. Yeah. It makes me think.
Doesn't feel right at all.
Doesn't feel right. But, you know, they come with their own GPS collar and temperature sensors so no one's leaving them in the car and things like that. And they come with prepackaged food. So next time you're in New York City or L.A. or San Francisco, you want to, you know, do this, you know, you can definitely, you know, get your, it's called Flex Pets. So, yeah.
Oh, boy. I think I'll take a pass on that.
All right.
What about these 200 retired racing greyhounds that are soon going to be evicted from Dairyland Greyhound Park? And, you know, Greyhound Pets of America is really hoping that people step up here.
They make such wonderful dogs. You know, yes, they are active dogs that love to run, but when they're not running, they are couch potatoes. And, you know, they've got short hair. They're a big dog, but they don't drool. You know, and I know the rescue groups are really good about checking the temperament and making sure that they, you know, if they're being put into a home, that the home has a fenced yard and that, you know, they've been checked to make sure they get along with other pets like cats and other dogs and so on. But, you know, if anybody's got room in their home and their heart for a great dog, I think these greyhounds would make wonderful pets.
Yeah. And the other option for the greyhounds is not a good one.
It isn't, unfortunately. And that's just part of the problem with racing, why it's so controversial.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like some more information about that, there's a website you can go to. It's an easy one to remember, www, of course, .gpawisconsin.org. GPA for Greyhound Pets of America, gpawisconsin.org, if you're interested in looking into that further, and I hope lots of people are. Well, Nick in Green Bay has a question for you, Sandy, so let's go there. Hi, Nick.
Oh, sure, just as I'm giving my dog some medicine. I got a question for you. I brought my dog in for allergies.
Uh-huh.
And she gave me some steroids, and I looked on the internet, and she said there's some pretty severe side effects.
Mm-hmm.
So I refused to give them to him. And I was wondering your opinion. I can tell you the name of the medicine if you really want to.
Sure.
Prednisolone.
Yes, yes. Prednisone or prednisolone is a type of an oral steroid that for short-term use when we have a pet with allergies is able to, you know, take the fire out of their skin, make them feel a lot more comfortable. And steroids do have a place in treating many, many diseases. But the thing is, you need to be able to use them correctly. And by correctly, I mean at the right dose for your pet. And I would hope your veterinarian has dosed your pet correctly. And usually we use them for a few days and then gradually taper them down and get them to an every other day dose and get them off of it. One of the things that I will do for clients that have pets with allergies is, you know, I don't want owners to get their pet hooked on steroids. By this, I mean, they work so well to suddenly have a dog that's not itching. You know, you're going to have people coming back saying, can I have some more? Can I have some more? And then before you know it, you're going to have all the side effects because they've been on it for so long. So the way I tend to dose steroids is I give a yearly amount and say, here's 30 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. That's what you get for the year. Make it last. And that doesn't go very far, but it makes owners realize that, you know, these drugs do play an important part, but there's other things that we can do to keep the itch under control. Sometimes things like topical steroids in the ears or on the feet help reduce some of the side effects, although they still can be absorbed and cause some issues. Making sure that you're treating secondary infections like yeast infections and bacterial infections, which can add to the itch. And then be looking at using other drugs that may be, that have their own side effect pattern, but will help control allergies long term, like cyclosporine, which is a immune modulating drug that's used for in high doses for organ transplants and things in people and cats, but at lower doses for controlling allergic symptoms in pets. It goes by the brand name of Atopica, is one of the brand names that's out there. So the only brand name that's out there if your veterinarian is going to be dispensing it. So, you know, be looking into those things as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now the side effects, are those severe? She said kidney failure, and he couldn't, sometimes he'd be weak and he wouldn't be able to get up. And I mean, he's only a 5-year-old dog.
So yeah. The big side effects with steroids are drinking more and urinating more. Not usually kidney failure, but they can get, they will drink more and urinate more, which can be a management issue. They're sometimes hungrier and they want to eat more. It can cause some elevation in some of the liver enzymes, and they will eventually, it's one of those temporary things. It's an effect of the drug, but usually the liver doesn't get, you know, diseased because of it. The big problem is it suppresses the adrenal glands, these two little important glands in the body that help manage, you know, your body's stress levels and electrolyte levels. And when we start suppressing the adrenal glands, you know, a long-term use of steroids can do that, then you can run into some pretty serious issues. So, you know, again, that tends to be after they've been on them for a long period of time. The drinking more, urinating more, and eating more, you're going to see that pretty well right away. But the more serious ones are usually after they've been on it for a long, long period of time. And I hope that, you know, your dog has other ways of finding relief than just depending on steroids.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you very much, Nick, for calling. Appreciate it. Jennifer and Kiwani, we're on to you now. Hi, Jen.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to know if your guest knows of any canine massage therapy schools in Wisconsin.
Well, I don't. I don't know of any canine massage therapy schools, but, you know, all these ancillary treatments for various things, like physical therapy for dogs and so on, has become such a, you know, a big business in the veterinary world, because we're recognizing the benefits that pets get from it, just like humans do. Mm-hmm. What I would recommend is, if you were to call the veterinary school, we do have a physical therapist on staff who probably would know people that are, you know, doing that field of pet massage and rehabilitation and so on. Her name is Courtney, and she's probably going to be going, why are you calling, having them call me? But if you call the veterinary school, 608-263-7600, she would probably be able to hook you up with or give you some information. I hope she can. If not, Courtney, I'm sorry. but that would probably be your first step of finding a place like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. And, you know, I have a friend who's has an older, quite a bit older dog, and she takes the dog to a chiropractor,
mm-hmm.
who is,
mm-hmm.
is also trained in this for animals, but
right.
he does people and animals.
Right, right.
And she says the dog has gotten a lot of relief from it.
Definitely. So. And, I mean, it serves a purpose just like it does for us. Acupuncture, chiropractic care, massage, nutritional management of diseases, those are all things that, you know, we traditional veterinary practice sometimes forgets about. But mm-hmm. They all serve a purpose. And there are vets out there that are doing this more and more.
Yeah. Thanks, Jen, for calling. Appreciate it. Catherine in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Your turn. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about treating for fleas. We have a kitty cat, a long-haired kitty cat. We've never had flea problem before, but one day when I was petting her, I felt a little bump or two on her neck, and as I was investigating it, saw the little flea crawling around in there.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
an indoor
what we've done so far is we've actually bathed her, and we got some of the Frontline to use on her. And we also got some for our dog, too, although we haven't seen any problems on him. Now, we haven't seen any more fleas on her. This is since last week. Besides being vigilant about vacuuming, what else should we be doing?
Well, this just goes to show you that, you know, with this weather we've been having outside here, fleas and ticks are still with us. And we had just the other day a Good Samaritan bring a bunny in that had been hit by a car right in front of the veterinary school. And as they were bringing it in, it was expiring in the waiting room. And, of course, covered with fleas. And we know that you know, at least in the raccoon world, I'm changing species here, but about 30% of the raccoons in our area are infested with the cat flea, which is the main flea that affects dogs and cats in our area. And so, you know, wildlife carries them. They come around, hang around your bird feeders at night. Your cat's a hunter and maybe catches a baby bunny. And as their body temperature cools, fleas are going to start to leave and find another body to go to. So it's really important that if you have pets that are indoor, outdoor, that you use flea control on them. And even if your cat is strictly indoors, you've got a dog that goes in and out, you make sure you're using flea and tick control on your dog, because they could bring fleas in to your cat and then your cat can get infested as well. You're doing the right thing. Bathing may help get rid of some of the flea dirt or droppings. It may make the cat feel a little bit better, but it does very little for long-term flea relief and control.
So we don't have to do that anymore.
You know, you probably don't. Cats don't see the humor in being bathed. So
is a good thing that we don't have to then. Humored by that.
Yeah, the spot-on products that are out there, like Frontline, Advantage, there's another one called Promaris. There's a whole bunch of them out there, are very effective, and they give you long-lasting relief. The pet, you know, can you just apply it topically, and away they go. But make sure you're using the right dose, and that you're using a cat-labeled product, not a dog-labeled product on your cat.
Right.
Vacuuming is going to take care of getting most of the flea eggs, maybe some of the larvae, the flea droppings that the fleas may be living on. Because remember, the tip of the iceberg is what's on your pet. The rest of it is in the environment, all the immature stages. Mm-hmm. Vacuuming, throwing the vacuum cleaner bag out, and paying very close attention to where the pet sleeps, because that's where most of the flea eggs are going to be, and where the flea droppings and so on for the flea larvae to live on. So washing bedding, you know, paying a close attention to areas where your pet likes to sleep, and vacuuming those spots. But with these really good products that we can use on the pet, we rarely have to resort to using environmental sprays, which I like, because the thought of putting insecticides in my home where I'm exposed to them makes me really uncomfortable. But the product your veterinarian recommended, Frontline, great product to use. So I would maybe in the next 2 to 3 months I'd keep up your treatments.
All right, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Sandy, did you have any recommendations, or would you have reservations, let's put it that way, about jogging on pavement with a less than one-year-old Akita weighing 90 pounds? The owner has been told by some that jogging is hard on the dog's joints. They don't go fast when they're jogging.
Yeah. You know, an Akita is a very large breed dog, and it's under a year of age, and large breed dogs will continue to develop their skeleton and their joints well past a year of age. And just like for racehorses, anytime we've got an athlete that's out there pounding that pavement, we've got to be really careful that we're not going to worsen or, you know, cause some problems with joint development. So my recommendation for especially giant and large breed dogs is probably wait until they're, you know, fully grown, a year and a half to maybe 2 years of age, depending on the size of the dog, before you start really hitting the pavement. You know, you can run with them at the dog park and maybe on softer surfaces and so on, but actually hitting the pavement like that could be a problem. So walking on pavement, not a big deal. Playing on grass, great idea, but probably leave the jogging till later in their dog's life. And be really careful, because if they suddenly start running on pavement, I've seen dogs actually denude their pads, have them just worn down to nothing where they're kind of little raw areas, and those are very difficult to heal and slow healing. So be aware that you kind of build the dog up slowly so they get a little callus development on their feet.
Let's go to Neetha in Mosinee. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
I have a 7.5-year-old female Rottie that was just diagnosed with having cancer in her shoulder.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
The x-rays, you cannot see one side of the bone at all, and you can only see the other side, which I'm afraid she's going to break that. My question is, her father died of the same thing, only down by his wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told at that time that the cancer had probably already spread, so there was no reason to remove the leg. So I've opted not to remove her leg. I don't want to do chemo. I have seen dogs that's been on chemo and they've been very sick, and I don't want to do that to her for her last days.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if Madison has any new studies or any new type of treatments out for her.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is something that there's always research going on, and I know we've got a number of clinical trials going on in our cancer department, and I would recommend that you call and speak with one of the people there. We do have different program assistants and so on that work with some of these clinical trials and see what they have going on. When it comes to my knowledge on osteosarcoma, which I assume is the type of cancer that
yes.
your dog's been diagnosed with, which is bone cancer,
yes.
By the time it's diagnosed, there's microscopic disease other places in the body, even though it may not be visible on, you know, abdominal ultrasound or x-ray of the chest or anything like that. There's still microscopic disease present. Amputation of the leg helps relieve the pain. I mean, this is an extremely painful type of cancer, and these dogs, yeah, and so that's one of the reasons why we do it. But you have to look at the dog's whole body. And
you put her on tramadol, and that seems to help.
Good, good. That's some excellent pain medication.
One more thing. She has gained weight. Even though I cut her food down, she has gained weight. So is that kind of like a telltale sign that something in the other parts of her body might be wrong?
Not necessarily. It may just be that if she, you've cut back on her food, but if she's not getting as much exercise because she hurts, she may still need to get even fewer calories than what you're feeding.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think that, you know, calling our oncology department, see what they have available. I know that there was some studies going on limb sparing types of treatment for osteosarcoma. But, you know, they would be able to let you know if there's any other protocols and things. And please don't, you know, think about, you know, just the downside of chemotherapy. We treat each patient as an individual. And unlike in the human world where, you know, they're throwing lots, I mean, pardon, I don't mean to be, you know, bashing human oncologists, but, you know, we're looking at trying to not only prolong our life, but perhaps cure us and, you know, put us into remission. In most of the cases when we're dealing with dogs and cats, we're looking at giving them good quality of life and giving them some extra life and, you know, not pushing them to the point where they may be sick with their medications. And so it's we kind of approach it a little bit differently than they may do in the human world. And most pets tolerate chemotherapy fairly well. So, you know, don't think that your pet may, you know, have trouble with it. They may do just fine.
And good luck. And I'm sorry for your situation, Neetha. Thank you very much for calling. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Shirley and Prentice has a question for you, Dr. Sandy. Let's go.
I'm wondering, do dogs see at night or in the dark somewhat the way cats do? And my second question, if you have a rescue greyhound, does the dog always have to be on leash, say you want a good walk in the woods, or do you need an electronic collar?
Well, let's answer the greyhound question first. It all depends on training. And, you know, greyhounds are sight hounds. And so they, you know, if they see something move or whatever, they may be more prone to run after them. But I think you can't generalize and just say they always have to be on a leash. I think it really depends on the dog and, you know, and the training that's involved. So once you get one and you start working with them, and little phrase to remember, if you can't control the dog, control the environment. So you start working with them off leash in areas where it's fenced, and you see if they come back and present them with different things. Maybe if they see a squirrel in the neighbor's yard, how do they behave? And if they're just real mellow and want to hang near you, they may be, you know, perfectly, you know, behaved off leash. But I'm not going to say every dog is going to be like that. It's really an individual thing. And your question regarding night vision, well, cats being more like kind of nocturnal predators, their retina is made up a little bit differently than dogs' retinas are. And so they have better ability to be able to see. You know, no animal can see in no light. Cats can see in lower light than human beings and dogs. And so dogs' night vision isn't quite as acute as it is in cats. And it's just, again, a difference in species.
Yep. All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling, Shirley. Appreciate it. Nick in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Nick.
Hi there. We need a lot of help for our little friends with fur and even feathers, but I'm curious as to help for our friends with gills. Fish veterinarians are very hard to find. I'm wondering if this is an area in veterinary medicine that's growing, or we should expect it to be this tough in the future.
Yeah, you know, this is an area that there's a, you know, aquaculture, and there's a, actually a program that vet students can participate in. It's not taught as part of the regular curriculum, but during their summer breaks when they're between their first and third year, some of the students here in Wisconsin will actually take part in a aquavet program, and they have, you know, various levels of it to be able to develop some proficiency in the medicine of fish, whether it be fish farming or, you know, expensive fish like koi and tanks and so on. You know, finding somebody that is in the Midwest able to deal with fish, you know, most of the people you're going to be finding that deal with this kind of thing are probably going to be more coastal or, you know, working with, you know, corporations and so on that are raising fish. I know that we had one veterinarian graduate and specialize in this, and he actually came to Wisconsin Public Radio a couple of times,
yep.
And I think his name is Myron Kibas, I think is his name. I'm not sure where he's located, but if you were to go to the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association's website, you can look up various specialty areas in the veterinary world, and probably by plugging in your, you know, where you live, they can tell you, you know, who specializes in what in your area and find out who the closest fish specialist is.
Great, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, he was on the show a couple times.
Several, and, I mean, that was probably a good 10, 15 years ago, but yeah.
Yeah, it was a while back. Robert in Marshfield, we're on to you now. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've got a six-year-old Doberman Pinscher with some skin allergy problems, and we've tried everything from changing the food to topical sprays, and I'm just kind of lost as to what else we can do to help her.
Wow, you should have been here when we first started the show, because that was, we kind of talked a little bit about allergies at that point.
I missed you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. There's a whole host of things that we can do. You know, number one thing, when you've got a dog that itches, they break their skin open and they'll get secondary infections. So we always got to get those under control. So a visit to your veterinarian to get some skin scrapings, impression smears, and so on done of key spots, ears, between the toes, you know, the belly area. A lot of Doberman Pinschers will end up getting secondary infections along their back, and it's a kind of a little bit different than some other breeds. The shorter hair dogs will get kind of these little bald spots and scabby areas up along their back rather
That's
than on
correct.
Their belly. So if you're dealing with that, then your pet probably has a deficiency in antibiotics and needs to be on antibiotics. Treating with antibiotics, important that you use it for the full term. And by that, I mean usually a minimum of 30 days of antibiotics. It takes a long time to reach therapeutic levels and to get this under control. It's usually been going on for a while. And you may see the dog look better after a week or two. And the worst thing you could do would be to stop, because it's just going to come back with a vengeance. And we end up creating more risk of resistant organisms. And we in the veterinary world are just as afraid of MRSA, the methicillin-resistant yeah. staph, and dogs have their own problems with their own staph. It's called staph intermedius. So use the appropriate antibiotics for the right length of time. And then, you know, when you're also looking at other things that you can do, we talked earlier in the show about oral steroids for a brief period of time to help stop the itch scratch cycle. Topical steroid sprays may be helpful. There's other drugs that help modify the allergic response. One's called cyclosporine, and that's something that is a little pricey for a big dog like your dog, but is very effective and relatively safe to use. Sometimes balanced fatty acids are helpful as well. But, you know, the gold standard would be to find out what your dog's actually allergic to, and a visit to a veterinary dermatologist to have some skin testing done, or even talking to your veterinarian about blood testing for allergies to see just what, you know, kind of things your dog's allergic to. And then that may be something that a allergy shot can be developed that's specific for your dog's needs and teach you okay. how to do that. And that may help desensitize your dog.
Do you see a lot of food allergies with today's dog food still?
No, I mean, food allergy, I think, you know, people would like to, we do see food allergies, but they're not as common as environmental allergies. But, you know, one of the things that we'll do is sometimes put pets on a hypoallergenic diet. And by that, I don't mean just changing from one brand to another, but actually going to a therapeutic diet that's a hydrolyzed protein diet that is, usually they're made out of chicken, and they are broken down into little amino acid parts that the body, the dog's body, is not going to recognize where it came from. And we need to feed that and only that, which means even things like heartworm preventative, we have to revamp so we're not given that chewable little beefy square. They get no treats, they get water, and that diet for usually we're looking at 6 to 8 weeks or longer to be able to determine how much of it is actually food related.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for your help.
You bet. Thanks, Robert. Sally in Wayland, Minnesota. On to you now. Hi, Sally.
Hello, folks, and happy election day.
Yes.
Yeah. It's so exciting. I'm actually giddy.
Well, me being a Canadian, I get to listen to all this and pay my taxes, but I can't vote. So,
hey, yeah. We're trying. We're trying down here. We're trying really hard. We're going to try and fix it. My question is, I have goats for milk, and I have chickens for eggs. And a friend of mine, we were talking, oh, my God, don't you know that your chickens can give your goats coccidia? And I went, oh, well, I'll find out. And so I guess my question is, what is coccidia, and why do I care? How do I know if my chickens have it? How do I know if my goats have it? And you know, what are its effects to me and the eggs and the milk?
Well, coccidia are it's a protozoal organism that lives in the intestinal tract. Every species has their own individual coccidia organism. So I deal primarily with dogs and cats, and we see them developing one that's called isospora. And, you know, chickens have their own coccidia, and goats get their own coccidia, and they usually don't cross from one species to another. So I wouldn't get too worried about your chicken and your goats, but if anybody else is, you know, an expert out there on this, please feel free to give me a call back. But I know that, you know, what I know of coccidia, it can cause diarrhea and weight loss, and sometimes it's really severe disease, like, you know, dehydration and so on. And, you know, when you're dealing with a flock situation where they may be stressed because of the way they're housed, it can be a problem. And I know that some commercial diets are actually, you know, they put coccidia static agents, treatment for coccidia, actually in the food. So the animals are actually eating it to be able to keep it under control. When we're dealing with dogs and cats, for the most part, if they're asymptomatic, they'll clear it on their own. But for puppies and kittens that may be going through some stressful times in their life, like vaccinations and spaying and neutering and, you know, training classes and diet changes, treatment is indicated. And the treatment that we usually use in our dogs and cats are a drug. It's a family of drugs called sulfa. And we use one called sulfadimethoxine. You have to go for usually 2 to 3 weeks of treatment to be able to get it under control. So I think the best thing I can tell you is talk to the veterinarian that you work with. And if you are concerned about, you know, the quality of their stool, definitely take a stool sample in and have it evaluated for parasites, because that's how you diagnose it, is on a stool check.
All right. Thanks, Sally, for calling. And Nancy in Fall Creek, we are on to you. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I moved to a hobby farm a couple years ago, and when we moved there, there was some feral cats in and around the barn, you know, three of them. They would, get mice and everything like that, but they were feral. There was no getting close to them. And I'm just wondering if there's a feed-through birth control that we can give them.
Oh, I wish there was, but man, there isn't. There isn't. And I think, you know, one of the best things you can do would be to, I mean, we have locally a group called Friends of Ferals, which is a group of people that want to work with feral cats, veterinarians, technicians, and so on. who can give you some advice as to how to trap, get these cats taken care of, spayed, neutered, tested for infectious diseases like feline leukemia, FIV, vaccinated, and then released again. And I know that they are, you know, really adept at dealing with some of these, you know, wild cats, and they truly are wild animals if they're feral animals. And so be careful, because they've not been vaccinated. They, you know, can, you know, cause a lot of bodily harm to whoever's catching them. So probably you're looking more at live traps to be able to catch them. But yeah, contacting through the Dane County Humane Society here in town, a group called Friends of Ferals. And I don't know if they've got a website or not, but that might be another thing that you could look up. And I know the veterinarian that does a lot of the work, her name is Dr. Sue Krebsbach. She's one of our local vets in town here and does a lot of really good work with these kitties.
All right, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Lori in Madison next. Lori, hi to you.
Hey, good morning, Larry and Dr. Sawchuk.
Hi.
I stood in amazement this summer watching my Springer help herself to a cucumber growing on the fence.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, that's where all my cucumbers are going.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if it's okay for her to have those. She likes green beans. She likes carrots. I haven't tried tomatoes, but I'm just wondering if any of those, she certainly doesn't get a lot.
Yeah.
But could they be an issue?
When I was a kid, I had a Springer Spaniel. We had two apple trees in our backyard, and she learned how to stand on her back legs and almost like dance in the air and turn circles like a little ballerina to catch the apples on the lower branches. And
yes, she's eating those too.
Yeah. And actually, unless they've been treated with some type of pesticide, probably not going to cause her any trouble. If she swallowed a big chunk of it, it could act as a foreign body, you know, obstruct her esophagus or act as a, you know, foreign body in her stomach. But for the most part, it's digestible and she's probably just chewing it up. And I'd recommend putting a good fence around your garden so that you do enjoy your vegetables. But one thing that pet owners need to be really aware of is grapes. If you're growing grapes in your backyard and you have a dog that likes to eat those, that could be a big problem, because just a few grapes can put a dog into kidney failure. So,
kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, no grapes, no raisins for dogs. It's a unique problem for dogs. Doesn't seem to affect cats. Obviously doesn't affect people. But it's a unique problem for dogs. So don't grow grapes in your yard. I put in a couple of grapevines, but I put them on the other side of my fence so that my dogs don't have access to them.
All right. Good luck, Lori. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have some emails. First from Diane, has a miniature schnauzer about 2 years old, diagnosed with having a portal systemic shunt about 9 months ago. Took her in for an ultrasound, and usually 75% are found through the ultrasound. She, however, falls into the 25% not seen in the ultrasound. How crucial is it for this to be fixed, and what would you expect her lifespan to be without the surgery? She shows no physical signs but was diagnosed through blood tests.
Oh, boy. Yeah, this is a disease that's very, very complicated. Part of the anatomy in your body is when you have blood supply leaving your intestinal tract, taking away not only important nutrients but also toxic material. It needs to go through the liver to be processed, to be take the toxins and ammonia and different things out of there that can affect the body. And when we have dogs with portal systemic shunts or portal caval shunts, there is a blood vessel that bypasses the liver, and this toxic blood is actually just dumped back into the general circulation. And so dogs that are clinically affected by this will tend to be runty and small because they're not getting the basic nutrients that they need too, because it's not getting to the liver. They may have neurologic signs where they seizure, they may be kind of demented and, you know, not quite all there, very poor learners. And, you know, for the most part, these dogs will end up going, if it goes untreated, their liver will atrophy over time, and they can, you know, run into, you know, very serious liver complications as well. You know, treatment, if you're looking at just kind of medical management, low protein diets, there's actually a diet that Hills makes called LD, liver diet, that might be helpful for your dog. We'll also put them on drugs that will help keep the stool from building up in the colon, stool softening agent. agents, one called lactulose is usually used, and then we'll often put them on neomycin or another antibiotic to help cut back on the gut flora that is breaking down protein and turning it into ammonia. So there's a number of things like that that we can do, but unfortunately, if they can't find where the shunt is on ultrasound, and maybe you're looking at, having an MRI study done or some dye studies to be able to see, if a portogram or something like that may be helpful as well. So there's other diagnostic tests besides ultrasound that may help you. And if your veterinarian has not referred you to a specialist to have this looked at, that may be the next step to have this looked into.
All right. And Alan emailed us, has a 3-year-old mutt that they recently rescued. Had the dog for about a month. He has very loose stool since adoption. We've changed his food twice with no effect. We've heard that canned pumpkin can help. Is this true?
Well, canned pumpkin is a source of fiber. And if the dog has fiber-responsive intestinal problems, then that may be helpful. But the number one reason why dogs have, especially new adopted dogs, have diarrhea issues is parasitism. And even though they may have had a stool sample checked, there is a very elusive parasite that I have had once, and I would rather give birth again than ever have this parasite.
Giardia.
It's called Giardia, yes. And
I've had it too.
Very difficult to diagnose because they don't always shed in the stool. So sometimes we'll resort to just response to therapy. And if your pet has not been hit with a good broad-spectrum anthelmintic or deworming agent, usually we'll use a combination of two drugs, one called fenbendazole and then another one called metronidazole. Using those in combination will usually knock this out. There is another test that can be done called a Giardia antigen test, which is still a stool check, but costs a little bit more money, but it's a little bit might be a little bit better depending on the level of experience of the technician doing the stool evaluation than just a standard stool check. So response to deworming or, jumping in and saying, let's do some more diagnostic tests. And to be honest with you, I usually just say, let's just try the meds first because they're safe and usually very effective.
Okay, and on to going back, I should say, to another call regarding Friends of Ferals. Dane County Friends of Ferals has a website. There's one in Milwaukee with a website.
Okay.
And there may be more. I went on to a search engine.
Okay.
And looked, so
good.
They're there.
All right.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Tom in Stevens Point is up next, so let's go right there. Hi, Tom.
The weather is absolutely beautiful here today, and I hope it holds out for a while.
I agree.
My question is a little bit more on the behavioral side. We have a 3-year-old black and tan coonhound black lab mix. She's a great dog. Pretty much exhibits most black lab type behavior, has never harmed another dog or another person, but the older she gets, the more aggression she has towards other dogs her size. She's always trying to dominate, and it seems like maybe protect, like my kids that are taking for a walk and stuff. I was wondering if there's any way to curb that behavior so she's as friendly with other dogs as she used to be.
Yeah. And part of this may be that she's getting older and she's like now in what we call the social maturity stage. But, when we're dealing with aggression, the thing you need to realize is you have to get a diagnosis. There isn't just like, here, it's not a single cause. It could be that she's afraid of other dogs. It may be that, there's a reason why they give female dogs a bad name, that she's just, controlling and more assertive with other dogs. It may be that she's more territorial, that it's like a leash associated. I'm like my moving territory. It's potentially possible that she's trying to protect your kids. But I think you really need to work with a certified animal behaviorist to be able to see your dog in these situations. A few things that I would be recommending is, just before you get to that point, get her fitted with a good head collar and perhaps even a soft touch harness to be able to have good control over her. Because if you're using a regular collar and she's pulling forward and you're pulling back, that message that you're sending down that leash is, telling her this might be something that you really should be afraid of or that I'm afraid of and could be driving this. So having better control over her. go back and work on your obedience skills where you've got a dog that is paying attention to you, that can sit and stay and look at you while you are, you know, just in a non-stressed environment at home. Because those are going to be things that if you are going to be working with a trainer or behaviorist, you're going to need to be able to have those basic skills, because usually we're looking at working with therapy dogs where we're taking her out for walks while other dogs are walking by at a distance and then gradually coming closer while she, you know, relearns or you learn how to deal with her social skills and get them revamped. So, you know, it's not something you probably want to attempt on your own. This could be very dangerous.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Tom. Jackie in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning.
Morning.
Tim said maybe I can get some common sense from your vet.
Okay.
I trust her. I have two dogs right now. One is a very well-mannered, we're doing fine, Chow Chow, a year. I have a rescue that I got in 2006, a Jack Russell Chihuahua mix.
Okay.
He has high blood pressure.
Okay.
I have never heard of that before.
Yeah.
When I take him, the first time I took him to the vet, I got him in 2006. The first time I took him to the vet, he was pretty good. The next time, he was a little more hyper. The next time they came out to clip his toenails, he went berserk.
Okay.
His ears got red. His eyes got red. He has only done this a couple of times at home.
Uh-huh.
Is there something I should do if I'm going to be taking him to the vet again? Is there something I can give him?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the fact that you brought up high blood pressure, I mean, this may just be situational where, you know, the dog is scared and their heart rate's gone up and their temperature's gone up and they're just, their heart's pumping like crazy. And we'll see dogs that will just do that. And it's not because they're hypertensive. It's just that they're all, you know, all worked up.
Sometimes at home, it doesn't have to be a particular thing. I feel his ears.
Mm-hmm.
That is one way. And they are so warm.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that high blood pressure?
Well, no.
Other times,
yeah.
He's, you know.
Well, we do see dogs developing hypertension, but unlike in people, we rarely see dogs developing what we call essential hypertension where, I mean, I'm hypertensive. I take a couple of antihypertensive drugs and yet I'm, you know, normal weight and, you know, in my mid-50s and it's still something that happens and you know, it's just because it's kind of the nature of being human. But in dogs, the two most common reasons why we'll see dogs becoming actually hypertensive where when they're quiet and just sitting there and you actually put a little blood pressure cuff on and check their blood pressure are kidney disease or kidney failure. And the other one would be a condition called Cushing's disease, which is an overactive adrenal gland. So it doesn't sound like that's what's going on with your dog. And usually the symptoms of hypertension in dogs are, you know, we recognize it if we diagnose either of those diseases when we start following up and checking their blood pressure. Sometimes they'll have visual changes, retinal hemorrhages, maybe something that we'll see. Sometimes they'll have, you know, vascular accidents and so on. But usually it's one of those things where we are suspicious of it because of the other diseases that we're dealing with.
Is Sounds there any like- way that the fact that he had been on, when I got him, he was overweight, putting him on diet and everything, and he still gained weight? Would that have anything to do with a thyroid? That's been checked.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and dogs, it's possible that your dog is hypothyroid. But just remember, little tiny dogs need little tiny amounts of food. And just because you put them on a diet dog food, that's like me eating light Twinkies. I mean, they make light food for people, but you can still overdo it. You've got to be really careful that you're feeding the right caloric needs for the amount of energy that your dog's expending. So working with your veterinarian to come up with the caloric needs for your dogs, they can say, this is how much your dog weighs or should weigh. Here's how many calories a day they should take in. And, you know, being careful that you're not getting, you know, stuck in the giving them rawhide, human food, treats, and so on that can blow a diet all out of the water. So, you know, getting the weight off your dog may be helpful, but I don't think your dog is probably hypertensive. It sounds like your dog just gets upset. Maybe, you know, the ears may be warm because it has an ear infection, or they're hot for some other reason, but it sure doesn't sound like your dog is hypertensive. So I think it's just your dog's upset.
To the vet before Should I give him something? Is there something?
Yeah, work with your veterinarian on this. To get nails trimmed and to be able to do an adequate physical, it may be necessary that your dog have a little sedation or an anti-anxiety drug given prior to the appointment. And, you know, have even making sure that, you know, when you go in, if you can't give your dog something at home, if they're not fed any breakfast, then injectable drugs may be able to be used because your dog's got an empty stomach. And sometimes chemical restraint is necessary. I had a dog in the other day, just even look at its ear. It took, you know, working with it with three people and chemical restraint to be able to get the dog so it was quieted down enough that we could finally get its ear cleaned out. So it's, you know, that's just, you know, individual dog variations. And I'm glad you've got a nice chow chow. And I hope you can, you know, have your dog, you know, get to the vet and have a non-traumatic experience with a little chemical help.
Thank you for calling, Jackie. Appreciate your call. And we'll take some more calls here. Ray in Genoa City up next. Hi, Ray.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've got two golden retrievers. And hunting season started for duck and geese and pheasant a little while ago. And I've taken the boy out quite a bit. I'd say 4 or 5 times a week, he and I at least go out and go hiking. And for about every 5 miles I do, he does about 20.
Okay.
He has leaned up beautifully. I've always had lean dogs, fit dogs. But he seems to have lost more weight this year than I've noticed him lose in the past. He's a three-year-old boy now. I feed just regular Purina dog chow. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any lethargy. He doesn't have any real changes other than the lean that's starting to come into him.
Okay.
Do you recommend changing dog foods for hardworking dogs or dogs that are seasonal? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, good question. You know, first of all, if you haven't had your dog in for a good physical exam, stool check, you know, just making sure that there's no other underlying reason why your dog may be losing weight. It could just be that him being such a tremendous athlete, he's burning too many calories, unlike the last dog that's probably taking in more calories than it needs, being a little lap dog. Your dog may be needing to go on one of those performance-type foods, which is the higher calorie. Usually they're higher fat dog foods. It's going to meet the dog's energy needs. These would not be appropriate foods to have dogs on that are not working like your dog. So for your other dog that's at home, that's, you know, more, you know, just a, you know, standard golden retriever, don't allow that one to get fat. But yeah, doing a gradual change because these tend to be richer foods. You don't want to just cold turkey your dog on one and switch him to this, but do it gradually over several days, but only after you've had a clean bill of health from your veterinarian.
And thanks for calling. Lyman in Marshfield, your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a 5-year-old Springer Spaniel, and a couple of years ago he started to develop sensitivity to vaccinations.
Oh.
We tried to isolate the vaccinations and finally determined that he's actually sensitive to the serum or carrier for the vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And it was suggested that we eliminate all vaccinations, which we've done, and he's perfectly healthy. But now we're coming up on the 3-year rabies vaccination, and I'm concerned, you know, how do we approach that one?
For liability reasons, yes. You know, and we do see vaccines, they're necessary to keep dogs healthy and cats healthy and humans healthy and so on. But there are some patients that just, you know, can't handle them because they can have life-threatening reactions. I'm allergic to rabies vaccine, and I was last vaccinated in 1983, and I'm still well protected because I go in, and every once in a while when I'm getting blood drawn, they'll check what's called a rabies titer, which is your measure of your antibody response to the vaccine. And we can do the same thing for dogs. There's one lab in the country that I'm aware of that runs rabies titers, and it's in Kansas. And there's kind of two rabies titer testing you can do. One that's just diagnostic, which would be for a case like your dog, where we just want to get a number back. And we know that, you know, above a certain level, dogs are well protected, and just monitor your dog that way. Here in Dane County, our animal control agencies, we can, as long as there's a letter with the results written by a veterinarian saying, you know, it's life-threatening reaction. This dog can't be vaccinated. Similar to what I give my employer, saying I can't be vaccinated, but I can still come to work because I'm protected. They allow them to be licensed with that. So I think that, you know, it may mean talking to your local animal control agency and having your veterinarian write up a letter just saying, you know, we could kill this dog if we continue to vaccinate. But here you go. Here's showing a, you know, a piece of paper showing this dog is well protected. And the other type of rabies titers we can do is for export. And for those cases, the dog's going to England or rabies-free countries, they have to be microchipped and they have to jump through a lot more hoops. But I think for diagnostic samples, it's just a matter of getting a blood sample done.
That's exactly what I need to know. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right. Thanks for calling. And Buddy in Pewaukee, on to you now. Hi, Buddy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a 5-year-old lab who was reverse sneezing or whatever you call it for about 2 months. And we took her to our regular vet, and she tried antibiotics and this type of thing because it's one nostril. The antibiotics changed nothing, so she recommended a surgeon. The surgeon did all the blood tests and what have you, and we had her in there for a day. They knocked her out, and he said he tried for an hour and a half to get the probe through, and he couldn't. And he tried flushing it, and he took a biopsy, but he did not cut it out.
Okay.
Why would he not cut it out?
Because it's in the nose, and trying to work in a little cavity like that, I'm not sure what the diagnosis was, what they were seeing on scoping, but it sounds like your dog had what we call a unilateral nasal obstruction. And most common reason why we'll see that is usually tumor or a big granuloma or like scar tissue reaction. And, you know, initially getting a diagnosis by getting a piece of it is the first step. But most, you know, trying to surgically remove the whole thing, you never get it all. These dogs are, you're looking at usually radiation therapy, you know, follow up that way. So I hope with the biopsy that they got that you're able to get a diagnosis so that then you can approach the right, you know, do the right therapy right. to try to give your dog some time.
Right treatment. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here, happy to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Rachel in Fall Creek is online, so let's go to Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just moved this past weekend with my cat into my boyfriend's house. We came from a house that had 3 dogs and another cat, and since I've got here, my cat has stayed under our futon couch the whole time, and we've actually been having a really hard time getting her to eat anything.
Oh, my goodness.
So I don't know what to do. She's always been a really shy cat, so I don't know if I just need to give her time or if there's something you recommend.
Yeah, how many, this was just this weekend, so it's only been a couple of days that she's been hiding under there. Have you tried to up the ante food-wise and offer her canned food and things that are really tasty?
Well, she gets canned food.
Okay.
She's got a disease that deals with her bladder.
Okay, and that may be part of this, too, is that, you know, just she doesn't handle stress really well. And the disease that you're talking about, we call it sterile cystitis, or there's a number of different names for it, interstitial cystitis, that where cats will get bloody urine because their bladder becomes inflamed to secondary to stress. It's not an infection. There's no stones or crystals there. And that may be something that's going to happen with this as well. A couple things that I would recommend doing, you know, really making sure that she is eating, because if she's got a weight issue and she's starting to metabolize her body fat, even a few days of not eating could put a cat into liver failure. So you got to make sure that you're trying to get some food into her. So, you know, really good food, you know, leaving it, putting it under the futon to be able to get her to eat under there. Go to either your veterinarian or local pet store and buy some Feel Away. Comes in an atomizer. It's feline facial pheromone. It's a natural calming agent for cats that you just plug into your wall, and it's like aromatherapy with science behind it. So give that a try. That may make her feel a little more comfortable as well. And it, you know, it may just be if she's healthy and happy and just distressed, just a matter of time where she has the opportunity to learn the layout of a new place. I mean, it's a huge change. If she was dependent on the other pets to tell her when dinner time was and, you know, when people are coming, now she's lost all that companionship. So give her a little bit of time. Don't force the issue, but also don't let her lack of eating, go very long, because that could result in very serious consequences.
All right. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Abby and DeForest, your turn. Hi, Abby.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You're welcome.
I'm calling about my dog. I got him at the Humane Society a couple months ago, and I thought maybe this habit would go away once he got settled, but he's still doing it. He'll like constantly lick at his paw,
mm-hmm.
or even gnaw at it sometimes, and it hasn't gotten to the point where, you know, it might bleed or something, but I'm afraid that it will.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, we tried giving him, like, bones to gnaw on or something else to do.
Yeah.
But he'll get sick of that after a while, and he'll go right back to his paw, so...
Yeah, you know, and it's possible that this may be a behavior problem, but you need to rule out whether there's a medical basis as well. Sometimes dogs will lick at their feet, especially if they've got some infection between the toes or on the flip side, on the bottom of the foot between the pads. And which came first, whether the licking resulted in an infection or the infection's causing the licking. But, you know, having this, if this dog were to come into my office, I'd be, you know, taking out a little spatula and collecting, you know, pardon my language, with some of the toe jam, and having a look under the microscope and seeing what we've got going on there and treating the infection appropriately. And that may help get the licking under control. But we do know that some dogs will lick as a kind of a, like a kid sucking their thumb or twisting their hair, as a compulsive disorder where they just, it's a way of dealing with stress. And, you know, many times dogs that have been in a shelter and then a new home, separation anxiety is a big issue for them, and this is one way of them, sometimes just putting them in, I call it the licker's high, where they just, you know, they lick and it puts them off into another zone and makes them feel a little bit better. I'm not saying that he should continue to lick like that, because he could damage himself, but that's approached a whole different way. We're looking at psychoactive drugs and behavior management. You were right to try to redirect him to something else. You may have to come up with other things that you can redirect him to as well. But if you're also noticing that, you know, this is accompanied by other behavior problems, such as maybe barking when you leave him alone or urinating or defecating in the house, then, you know, looking at it from the behavior standpoint definitely needs to be, on the top of your list there. So it's interesting. I was just showing the surgeons yesterday. There's a new device for dogs, and I'm not recommending this because I've never used one.
Sure.
But it's a stick-on device that you can put around the dog's leg or on a bandage that actually has a little tiny battery in it. And when they lick, they get like a shock. It's like a little electrical stimulation.
A serious shock.
Not serious, but it's like, whoa, that's big time to be able to get a dog to stop licking. There are other agents on the market that taste really bad. And sometimes like deterrents like that, there's one that's called Yuck that we sell in our office, but you can get it at various things at pet stores. There's even one called Bitter Apple. Some dogs will just lick right through that. But be careful. If the skin is raw, you can't put it directly on the skin. You have to be careful where you apply it. So again, if you haven't been to your veterinarian about this, go there, get it looked into, and then maybe they can come up with a list of things that you can try.
All right. Thank you, Abby, for calling. Kyle in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. I'm calling. I've got a four-month-old beagle mix, and recently was diagnosed with HOD. I think it's a basically like growing pains with inflamed bones and stuff like that is a concern.
Mm-hmm.
But my concern is that usually from what I've found is this is usually in the larger breeds, and it seems that it's usually accompanied in most of the joints, and it's really localized in just one leg. So I'm kind of concerned if this is a possibility with a small dog. She's 12 pounds.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of weird, because usually it is large breed dogs, and you're right, it's usually multiple bones. And if x-rays have been taken, getting a second opinion on the x-rays may help to be able to find out what's happening that way. I'm not sure how it was diagnosed. Was it diagnosed with x-rays? Is that how your veterinarian came up with that diagnosis?
Yeah, it was a combination of x-rays and sort of elimination. They did the Lyme's test, and it showed up really nothing other than the probability from the vaccination that she received a little bit ago.
Okay, okay.
And then we do have the copies of the x-rays, but, I mean...
Yeah, yeah. And some, you know, I know at the veterinary school, we do have radiology consults, and people, veterinarians, mail in radiographs all the time to have our radiologists. And these are people that are board certified in radiology, look at the radiographs and help with, you know, coming up with a diagnosis or maybe a, you know, further diagnostic plan. So I think this would be something that I, again, it just kind of, you know, raises that question of, is this really what it is? And, I'm not faulting your veterinarian, but, you know, again, it sounds weird that one leg hypertrophic osteodystrophy is, you're right, it's one of these, you know, kind of young growing dog type problems, but 12-pound dog, kind of odd. Yeah. So,
and the other thing was that, I mean, there's no Lyme's present, and we've got her on a medication now, and it's accompanied with a mild fever as well. So I guess is usually typical to HOD, but I was just concerned that if it was something else.
There's other things like bone infections. I mean, does she have a joint infection? Is it an immune-mediated problem? You know, is it something like blastomycosis? There's, you know, a whole host of things. And so it may come down to, you know, looking at biopsying, taking joint fluid, you know, doing some other testing to try to get an answer. But it just sounds very, very odd to be this type of condition.
Okay, so you would recommend a second opinion then?
I would recommend a second opinion. Yes, I would.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for calling. And Steve in Stevens Point, hello to you.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Love
sure.
the show.
Thank you.
I have two cats. They're both male. They're both about 5 or 6 years old. We got them from the pound. They were cellmates there. And we got them about 3 years ago. One of them, I would say, would be dominant, but when they fight and play, he's always the one that runs away first.
Okay.
So, but the other one... is very skittish in the house when he's not in the bedroom. The bedroom seems to be his safe zone, if you want to call it that.
Uh-huh.
But the litter box and the food aren't up there. I'm not really sure. He's always been this way ever since we got him. And it's getting to be an issue. If we walk into a room where he's in, he'll see us and run away.
Mm-hmm.
But if we go and get him, pick him up and pet him and put him in the room, he'll be fine there. Until we make a move or some noise startles him and he runs away again. So.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the fact that he's been like this ever since you've had him and you got him as a young adult, it may just come down to the fact that he was probably poorly socialized as a kitten. And, you know, they although they may have been, as you said, cellmates, you know, even within a litter, you can have... I know one of my colleagues is taking care of a litter of kittens right now, and it's amazing the range of personalities from the outgoing, you know, I'm going to sit on your lap, to the one that's, you know, hiding behind a table and not wanting to come out. It's, you know, and so you can see, you know, just even within the same litter, differences in, you know, how they cope with changes in behavior. Probably one of the worst things you can do for a cat that's fearful is chase them down, grab them, hold them, and force the issue, because then every time they see you, they're going to think, uh-oh, that person's going to try to grab me again. Playing a little bit hard to get, you know, going into a room, just sitting quietly, reading a book, tossing treats towards the cat, you know, giving them that opportunity to interact with you and learn that you're not going to be reaching for them and trying to grab them and hold them in place. So I have a cat at home that I adopted, and she was about probably 5 or 6 months of age. I bought her an airline ticket. I was out in California and brought her home with me. She's now 4 years old, and I maybe can touch her maybe once a month or so if I'm lucky. For the most part, it's like we kind of coexist in the same house. She has a very nice life. She's quite happy. But I just, you know, accept her for as she is, and she accepts me for as I am. And we, you know, coexist together. And sometimes just accepting that that's the way it has to be is going to make life easier for everybody.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Connie in Park Falls has emailed us and is interested in employment and education in the vet tech or assistant field, and wondering if you could tell her if you know of any accredited online schools that she could go to. She lives in a very rural area. Traveling for school is not an option. Also, if it would even be in my favor to seek a vet assistant certificate, as I have heard that veterinarians usually do not hire anyone with less than a vet tech degree.
Yeah, some veterinarians do hire other people, lay help. And you may start out kind of at the bottom end of things, so to speak, cleaning kennels and things like that, just to get some animal handling experience to see if it's even a field that you'd want to be involved with. And I, you know, I've worked in many practices where there are veterinary technicians that are certified vet techs. And then we have, you know, just the trained help that are, you know, very, very effective at getting the jobs done that they're trained for. But there's certain things by law that they can't do. So, you know, giving injections and, you know, some of the, you know, anesthetic management and, you know, minor procedures and things like that. So that would be a good start, is working with a veterinarian just to see if it is a field you'd like to get into. I would recommend that you contact, here in the Madison area, we do have a technical college. Madison Area Technical College has a veterinary technician program. The technicians there, they may be able to put you in touch with other people that are, you know, I don't know of an accredited program within the state. There probably is some outside of the state. But again, you have to question, you know, just how good is, you know, a program where you really need a lot of hands-on learning, you know, making blood smears, you know, checking, you know, patient restraint, putting catheters in. I mean, all those things that technicians do every day, you're not going to be able to learn that through a book, and you are going to need a lot of hands-on training. So, you know,
maybe there's some sort of combination.
There might be, where you can get some book learning and then, you know, working with, at a vet clinic to be able to get the experience that you need so that you can then go on and take the state test and become certified.
Yeah. And let's see. Jason wonders, has an 8-year-old Vizsla with mast cell tumors. She was operated on last year to remove several tumors, but they've returned in other areas. What are the treatment options?
Well, surgery is by far the gold standard for treating mast cell tumors. Mast cells are cells within the skin that have granules that secrete various vasoactive substances like histamine. When we get stung by a bee, that's why we develop a big swelling, because our mast cells degranulate and we get this, you know, allergic reaction. Tumors, mast cell tumors, are quite common in dogs, and unfortunately, they're kind of like, you know, little octopuses. The site of the tumor is often not the whole thing. So you have to take very wide surgical margins when you're removing these things. And I know our surgeons will usually take at least 2 centimeters all the way around the mast. And that means deep as well as around the edges to be able to get rid of it. And then that tumor is actually sent in and they look to make sure that the margins are clean. And, you know, it's unfortunate that sometimes dogs that have this type of problem, they'll get, you know, more and more of them. So if they're occurring in different spots rather than the spot that the tumor was actually in, they're probably new tumors and you're looking at, you know, further surgeries to be able to keep this under control. Making sure that the tumors are graded as well. And there's a grading system that they use where, you know, you have like the not so bad ones that are usually very surgically correctable. And then the other ones that are more invasive, where you're looking at using ancillary treatments such as radiation therapy and chemotherapy and so on to try to get these tumors under control. So if you would like to work with a veterinary oncologist, we've got a great oncology unit at the veterinary school that would be more than willing to help you and give you their opinion as to, you know, what the prognosis is for the rest of your dog's life with this type of disease.
All right. Let's go to Matt in Marshfield. Matt, hello.
Hello. I have a 2-year-old English Cocker Spaniel, and she's a hunting dog. And when we go out hunting, she tends to get a lot of loose stool, and then after a while, after probably like a couple hours of hunting that, after all this running around, boning around, then she seems to get like constipated and seems to be like struggling to go in that. And normally when any other time, we don't have any type of issue. She has actually a real good stool and everything. It's just when she does a lot of this running and bounding around.
Yeah, and this may be like exercise-related changes in her stool consistency. Sometimes we will see that. And don't confuse constipation, which is the passing hard, tiny, firm nuggets with a dog that's straining because they have an inflamed colon. It may just be that the level of excitement and the stress of getting out, not that it's, you know, that stressful. She's obviously very happy and loves it, but they'll sometimes develop colitis or inflammation of the colon. And so even if just a little bit of stool's getting back there, it's going to be burning. So you're going to be seeing her, you know, continuing to strain, even though nothing's coming out. So, you know, if that's the case for her, if it's just a, you know, brief period of time, you know, maybe, you know, looking at light meals or low residue food before you exercise her, which would have not a lot of fiber in it, be something that'll kind of keep the intestinal tract empty, but give her all the energy that she needs. That may be very helpful. But it sounds like it's just exercise related. She gets over it very quickly. So, you know, I wouldn't get too concerned about it, but you may want to try that little diet change before you're hunting to a low residue type diet before getting out in the field.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Linda in Door County, on to you now. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a 3-year-old male golden retriever, quite a large boned golden. He's been diagnosed with low thyroid, and I was wondering, first of all, how much and what can I feed him to help him, other than exercise, get this weight off? And number two, are holistic diets good for dogs?
Well, I think the number one way of getting a dog with that's hypothyroid under control is with daily medication. It's usually twice a day thyroid supplementation, which will improve your dog's metabolism, because that's the whole thing. When their thyroid isn't working properly, and it's a very common problem in golden retrievers, their metabolism drops and then they, you know, just turn into overweight slugs. So this will get his metabolism back on an even keel. And then once you've got his thyroid level regulated, then you can be looking at how many calories does he actually need to be able to support his body weight. And I like to call golden retrievers kind of the economy model of the dog world. It doesn't take a lot of fuel usually to keep their engine running. And we tend to overfeed them because they like us to think that they're hungry all the time. So, you know, be careful that you are feeding them the right amount of food. And you know, I had a friend with an overweight Labrador retriever, and I asked her how much she's feeding. And she said, oh, just 2 cups a day. And I asked her to show me the cup, and it was a 4.5-cup stadium cup. The dog was getting 9 cups of dog food a day. So, and this is an intelligent woman. And I was like, oh, my God. So, you know, using a measuring cup, knowing how many calories are in a cup of dog food that you're using, watching the treats and things, and definitely keeping up with the exercise to help keep his metabolism going. Those are all going to be important ways to get your dog back into shape again.
Thanks, Linda. Dwayne in Chippewa Falls, on to you.
Yes, 2 quick questions, please. If your dog eats grapes and with the kidney failure, approximately how long before you would say see symptoms?
Usually within, you know, a couple of days, you're going to start running into troubles.
She did this months ago.
Okay. You know, and so, you know, the odd grape is probably not going to push the dog over. I never recommend having a dog eat them. But even for a large dog, one of those little mini boxes of raisins that, you know, little snack-sized boxes of raisins could be enough to put a dog into kidney failure. And also remember, the other thing that we didn't bring up this show, which we just had one of our receptionists, their dog ate a package and had a couple of pieces of the gum that's laced with xylitol. Xylitol is a sweetener that we handle very well, extremely toxic for dogs. And you know, there's enough toxin of that sweetener in a pack of gum to kill 2 large breed dogs. So in your standard pack of gum. So be really careful about that. We're finding out all these things kind of after the fact. And number one reason for cats going into kidney failure, though, I just was reading that in a journal article, Easter lilies, indoor lilies, cats chewing on leaves. So be careful about what houseplants you have if you've got cats.
All right.
If I may, dog has drainage in one eye each morning.
Mm-hmm.
Real heavy type drainage.
Yeah, and if it's, you know, just mucus, it may be nothing more than morning sleepers. If it's yellow or green accompanied by squinting, then you may have an eye infection or something that needs to be addressed.
So you need to go and talk to your vet about that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Anything in the last minute here, we have some dogs who get depressed during the winter treatments for depression in dogs?
Well, the number one thing is keep your schedule the same and keep them physically active. You know, the physically fit dog is going to, so going to doggy daycare, getting out and playing, you know, don't let them develop seasonal affective disorder by keeping them indoors. And, you know, I think that's the best thing you can do is keep their schedule the same and keep them active.
Sandy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. You'll be back again in a month?
I am, next month.
Yeah. Next month, she'll be back. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Always a pleasure, and she will be back. And sorry we had so many emails and calls we didn't get to, but that's the way it works sometimes. Tomorrow, I'll be away, fortunately or unfortunately. I have another meeting that I have to go to, but Jim Packard filling in for me, and he will be talking with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.